Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, April 1st, 2024. Thousands of families turn out for the annual White House Easter Egg Roll. First Lady Jill Biden talking about the theme of education. President Joe Biden saying Easter reminds us of the power of hope and renewal. White House responds to the Republican criticism of the president's proclamation of Transgender Day of Visibility on Sunday, same day as Easter. Maryland Governor Wes Moore provides an update on the recovery from last week's bridge collapse that has closed Baltimore Harbor and cut off a major surface transportation route. He says that safety is the priority. Already, six lives have been lost, and he doesn't want any more. Biden administration officials tell Israeli officials in a virtual meeting that Israel's security would be harmed by a military operation in the southern Gaza city of Rafah because it would further isolate the country on the international stage. Rafah is where over a million Palestinian civilians are sheltering and where Israel says Hamas fighters are hiding. And a tribute to former U.S. Congressman William Delahunt, a Democrat of Massachusetts, who passed away over the weekend. The U.S. Marine Band on the White House lawn performing Easter Parade. USA Today reports a little rain Monday morning couldn't stop the annual White House Easter Egg Roll. An estimated 40,000 people packed the lawn, enduring occasional raindrops for one of the White House's oldest traditions that dates back to 1878. Kids rolled and hunted for eggs in what officials said was the largest White House Easter egg roll ever. Other children heard stories in a reading nook. First Lady Jill Biden and President Joe Biden spoke from the balcony to the families below. The President and First Lady were flanked by two Easter bunnies.
Welcome to the White House Easter Egg Roll. Happy Easter, everybody. I'm a teacher, so I love any time when we can turn the White House into a classroom. And that's what we're doing today. The South Lawn is transforming into our learning playground and school community. And there's so much to discover. Listen to a story in the reading nook. Explore space. Make circuit breakers. Write notes to our troops. Take a field trip to a farm. Hunt for dinosaur fossils and so much more. Education expands our horizons and transports us to new worlds. Just like these balloons, it allows all students to soar and reach unimaginable heights. I hope that you all learned something new today. But most importantly, I hope you all have fun. And now it is my honor to please welcome my husband, the President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Happy Easter. Well, we did everything, but we couldn't control the weather. Although Al Roker told me this morning it was going to get sunny. Folks, welcome to what's expected to be the biggest White House Easter egg roll ever. I want to thank the National Park Service, the White House Historical Association, especially the American Egg Board, and our nation's egg farmers for the egg board. They've done a great job. And thank you for making this special tradition possible. You know, it began in 1878 because they wanted to have an Easter egg roll on the park grounds, but they weren't allowed to do it. So the president then said, let's have it at the White House lawn. They couldn't stop that. It's been going on since then. Easter reminds us of the power of hope and renewal, sacrifice and resurrection, but mainly love and grace toward one another. It's time to pray for one another, to cherish the blessings and the possibilities that we have as Americans. That's what I see in our country. We're a great nation because we're good people. Our values are solid. and the rest of the world looks to us, and we're determined to keep up that banner. And because of you, the American people, and I mean this sincerely, I've never been more optimistic about America than I am today. We have enormous opportunities. We just have to remember who we are. We're the United States of America, and there's nothing, nothing beyond our capacity. God bless you all. Enjoy the day, and I'm coming down to do that Easter egg roll in just a minute. Thank you all so very, very much. Thanks, everybody. And by the way, say hello to Oyster Bunnies. Come on up, bunnies. Get up here so they can see you. Come on, get in there. Pretty big bunny, huh? All right. Thank you all so very, very much. It's all yours. President Zone.
President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden at the White House Easter egg roll, speaking from the balcony. They both then joined the children on the South Lawn for the traditional egg race, wooden spoons used to move the hard-boiled eggs along. You heard the First Lady talk about her theme, education. There was a large schoolhouse on the South Lawn with activities for kids in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM subjects, including making circuit breakers and simulating a fossil dig. From the Associated Press, President Joe Biden is facing criticism from Donald Trump's campaign and religious conservatives for proclaiming March 31st, which corresponds with Easter Sunday this year, as Transgender Day of Visibility. The Democratic president issued the proclamation on Friday, calling on all Americans to join us in lifting up the lives and voices of transgender people throughout our nation and to work toward eliminating violence and discrimination based on gender identity. But in 2024, the March 31st designation overlaps with Easter, one of Christianity's holiest celebrations. Trump's campaign accused Biden, a Roman Catholic, of being insensitive to religion, and fellow Republicans piled on. Caroline Leavitt, Trump campaign press secretary, said, "We call on Joe Biden's failing campaign and White House to issue an apology to the millions of Catholics and Christians across America who believe tomorrow is for one celebration only, the resurrection of Jesus Christ." That was from Associated Press. The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre spoke about this at her news conference today.
The criticism over the Transgender Day of Visibility, the White House said that the president wouldn't abuse his faith for political purposes. Does the president think that's what Republicans are doing?
I mean, look, just a couple of things. And really, so surprised by the misinformation that's been out there around this. And I want to be very clear. Every year for the past several years, on March 31st, Transgender Day of Visibility is marked. And as we know, for folks who understand the calendar and how it works, Easter falls on different Sundays, right? Every year. And this year it happened to coincide with Transgender Visibility Day. And so that is the simple fact. That is what has happened. That is where we are. And I do want to say a couple of things because I think it's important here. As you just stated in your questions, what we've been hearing out there, a lot of misinformation done on purpose. And as a Christian who celebrates Easter with family, President Biden stands for bringing people together and upholding the dignity and freedoms of every American. Now, sadly, and it's not surprising, right? It is actually unsurprising that politicians are seeking to divide and weaken our country with cruel, hateful, and dishonest rhetoric. It is dishonest what we have heard the past 24 hours. It is untrue what we heard over the weekend. And, you know, we were at first, want to be very clear, confused on their coverage. We're grateful that Fox agrees with President Biden about the importance of recognizing Trans Day of Visibility. And I'll just quote something that Fox said back in 2021. They tweeted this: "Trans Day of Visibility is dedicated to celebrating transgender people. To all the transgender men, women, and non-binary folk, we see you and stand with you. President Biden will never abuse his faith or for political purposes or for profit. That is not what this administration is about. That is not what being a leader is about. And this misinformation out there is just, it's bad. And it is dividing, it is caused to divide us." And I want to say one more quote. This is what political covered. "Every year, And I said this at the top of my answer, Transgender Day of Visibility is on March 31st. This year, March 31st just so happens to be also Easter, the date of which changes every year. That's how I started out, and that's how I end.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre at the White House Press Conference. President Biden called House Speaker Mike Johnson's criticism of him over this thoroughly uninformed, for accusing him of declaring Easter Sunday Transgender Day of Visibility. Reporters then asked uninformed how, and the president said, "I didn't do that." Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, posting today, "If Biden didn't do it, who signed the name to the official proclamation? It's bad enough he deliberately desecrated the most sacred holy day in the Christian faith, then he lies about it." This also came up at a news conference with Governor Ron DeSantis in Miami, Florida.
President Biden's redubbing of the holiday as Transgender Day.
Wait a minute, he said that didn't happen.
He said he didn't do it. So which raises the question, either he's not being honest with the public or he really didn't know what was going on. And so my question would be, who's running the presidency? Is it a bunch of a woke 20-something-year-old White House staffers that just put out this drivel whenever they want? So I don't know who's in charge. The fact that he's not owning up to it, I don't. Either way, it's bad. Either he's not being honest, or he really didn't have anything to do with it. But what we did was we had a big Easter egg hunt. Kids were didn't even change when they got back from church. They went in. They found a lot of Easter eggs, and it was like a massive amount. I told my wife, I said, you know, that's a lot. And so they did that, and they were running around. And then it got to be, you know, we get in, you know, we had a nice meal. We did all that. So then we get into later in the day. No naps, just keep going nonstop. And I'm just like, you know, it's tough to keep up. But we had a good Easter, and it's an important the most important, you know, for Christians, the most important holiday on the calendar. And, when Biden did, I think it was ridiculous, but it does raise the issue. You know, you go back, you can see there's a picture that'll get circulated on the internet sometimes of the New York City skyline. And I think it was from like the 1950s. I think it was Good Friday. And you had the buildings lit up with crosses. Yeah, it was like big crosses.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, at a news conference in Miami. This is Washington Today. The White House says President Joe Biden will be traveling to Baltimore on Friday to visit the site of last week's collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge when a very large container ship hit the bridge. Associated Press reporting today the U.S. Coast Guard has opened a temporary alternate channel for vessels involved in the clearing of debris at the site of the collapsed bridge in Baltimore, part of a phased approach to open the main channel leading to the vital port. Crews are undertaking the complicated work of removing steel and concrete at the site of the bridge's deadly collapse. On Sunday, dive teams surveyed parts of the bridge and checked the ship, and workers in lifts used torches to cut above water parts of the twisted steel superstructure. Today, Governor Wes Moore, Democrat from Maryland, gave an update at a news conference in Baltimore.
Now, I know there is an urgency to move fast, and nobody feels that urgency more than the people standing up here today. But we have to be clear on the risks. This is a steel bridge that is sitting on top of a container ship in the middle of the Patapsco River. We are talking about tons of steel that is mangled and cantilevered. We're talking about water that is so murky and so filled with debris that divers cannot see any more than a foot or two in front of them. We're talking about a situation where a portion of the bridge beneath the water has been described by Unified Command as chaotic wreckage. Every time someone goes in the water, they are taking a risk. Every time we move a piece of the structure, the situation could become even more dangerous. We have to move fast, but we cannot be careless. I've been clear with this team that we have got to prioritize safety. And my directive is to complete this mission with no injuries and no casualties. We've already lost 6 Marylanders to this crisis. I refuse to lose any more. One of the mantras in the military is mission first, people always. And that's the mindset that we are going to apply to this work. Now, on clearing the Federal Channel and reopening the vessel traffic to the port, Unified Command has moved forward with their first crane operation. They cut up and lifted a piece of the north section of the Key Bridge. The entire operation took 10 hours. And in that time, they were able to cut and lift a 200-ton span of the bridge. Now, when we were getting that briefing, Unified Command said something that really struck me, where the Admiral says this was a relatively small lift. We're talking about 200 tons. We're talking about something that is almost the size of the Statue of Liberty. And what the Admiral said is right. It's a small piece of what we're talking about. The scale of this project, to be clear, it is enormous. And even the small lifts are huge. That's how we have to move forward. A temporary channel on the northeast side of the collapse opened earlier today. It will help us to get more vessels in the water around the site of the collapse. The temporary channel will be marked with government lights to aid navigation and will have a controlling depth of 11 feet. Now, we're also moving forward on creating a southwest channel for deeper draft vessels that will allow for a deeper draw. That channel will measure about 15 feet deep, and it will be open in the coming days.
Maryland Governor Wes Moore at a news conference in Baltimore. And as part of the assistance to help those affected by the bridge collapse and port closure, the governor posting today on X, last week the White House accepted our request to approve a Small Business Administration disaster declaration within hours. That declaration is now in effect, and small businesses affected by the disaster can now apply for disaster loan assistance from the federal government. Wall Street today, the Dow down 240, NASDAQ up 17, S&P down 10. From Reuters, United Parcel Service, UPS, will become the United States Postal Service's primary air cargo provider, the company said on Monday, as rival FedEx announced an end to its more than 20-year partnership with the Postal Service provider. The financial terms of the contract were not disclosed, but UPS said the award was significant. That from Reuters. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi there. I'm Jonathan from C-SPAN, along with my colleague, Ben. Since C-SPAN's founding 45 years ago, the media world has changed. Remember when there were just a few TV channels? Now we've got streaming, social media, apps, and more.
Through all of this, C-SPAN has stayed true to its mission of giving you unfiltered access to government wherever you get your news. As we navigate this challenging media environment with fewer people subscribing to traditional cable packages, our funding has been impacted.
That's why we're asking for your help to keep going strong for another 45 years. Please donate today at cspan.org/donate. Your contribution, large or small, helps ensure at least another 45 years of witnessing democracy in action.
Keep C-SPAN thriving in today's ever-changing media landscape. Visit cspan.org/donate to make your gift today. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcast and on our mobile app, C-SPAN Now. It's free. Some headlines from the war between Israel and Hamas. This from CNN. Israel's military said it has withdrawn from the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza City following a 14-day siege. A Gaza civil defense spokesperson telling CNN the complex, which was the enclave's largest medical facility, had been completely destroyed. Iran accused Israel of killing a top commander in its Revolutionary Guard in an airstrike on its consulate building in Damascus, Syria. At least five people were killed in the strike, including diplomatic staff and military advisors, according to Iran's ambassador to Syria. And the White House said that senior U.S. and Israeli officials are meeting virtually Monday as the Biden administration works to dissuade the Israeli government from a large military incursion into the densely populated city of Rafah. Some updates from CNN. That virtual meeting came up today at the State Department briefing with spokesperson Matthew Miller.
let's just start with Gaza. Two things. One, in terms of the Secretary's involvement or the State Department's involvement for this meeting, virtual meeting today, can you tell us with the Israelis about Rafah?
So the Secretary is at the White House right now, participating in the meeting with representatives of the Israeli government to lay out an alternative approach to dealing with the remaining Hamas battalions in Rafah. When I walked out, the meeting had not yet broken, or at least I'm not aware of it yet having broken, and expect a statement from the White House that's, upon its conclusion.
Okay. Well, was there anything specifically that the State Department wanted to convey, to get across to the Israelis in this meeting?
So I don't want to speak too specifically about the meeting that is, as far as I'm aware, ongoing. We'll have a statement afterwards, but the Secretary would, I expect, reiterate the concerns that he expressed when he was in Israel some 10 days ago now about the dramatic humanitarian impact of a full-scale ground invasion in Rafah.
And then, secondly, I presume that you've seen some of the images, video, and still photos, plus witness accounts, written witness accounts of what happened at the Shifa Hospital. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, so I have seen a few things. One, the accounts in the media from inside Gaza, and I, of course, have seen what the IDF has said about the operations that it has conducted, where it has said it has killed a number of members of Hamas and detained, I think, several hundred additional members of Hamas. We, as often is the case, don't have anyone the ability to get full ground truth because we don't have anyone on the ground in Gaza. I will say from our perspective, the things you have heard us say before, of course, remain true, which is we generally don't want to see Israel operating inside hospitals in Gaza. We want to see hospitals be protected sites. But it is concerning that after Israel had conducted an operation earlier in this campaign to clear al-Shifa, that al-Shifa again was apparently infiltrated by Hamas fighters. And so two things about that. One, look, obviously, we it would be great if Hamas would stop hiding behind civilians and stop hiding inside civilian infrastructure, including hospitals. But two, it points out what we have been saying all along, which is the need for Israel to have a sustainable long-term strategy when it comes to Gaza, that it's not enough to just clear certain neighborhoods or hospitals or any other geographic areas or buildings of Hamas. They need to have a long-term sustainable strategy that is not just a security strategy, but also a political strategy if they really want to secure the future of Israel against the terrorist threat that has to date emanated from Gaza.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller at his news conference today, getting questions from Associated Press reporter Matthew Lee. And the White House did put out a joint statement on the meeting of the U.S.-Israel Strategic Consultative Group, or SCG. It reads in part, the two sides, for the course of 2 hours, had a constructive engagement on Rafah. They agreed that they share the objective to see Hamas defeated in Rafah. The U.S. side expressed its concerns with various courses of action in Rafah. The Israeli side agreed to take these concerns into account and to have follow-up discussions between experts overseen by the SCG. The follow-up discussions would include in-person SCG meeting as early as next week. That statement from the White House. The story from The Hill, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, doubled down on her attacks on Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, on Monday, accusing the House leader of caving to Democrats on border security at the expense of public safety. Greene has been up in arms that Johnson recently endorsed a massive spending deal with President Biden to fund the government through September, a package that excluded the tougher border security measures many conservatives had demanded. Heading into another explosive debate, this one over military funding for Ukraine, Greene is amplifying both her opposition to that aid package and the pressure on Johnson to keep it off the floor. Unmentioned but hanging over the imminent debate is Greene's threat to remove Johnson from power if he contravenes her stipulations. If Speaker Johnson gives another $60 billion to the defense of Ukraine's border after he fully funded Biden's deadly open border, the cruel joke would be on the American people, Greene wrote Monday on X. And it won't be April Fool's. That was reporting by The Hill. Speaker Mike Johnson was interviewed by former Congressman, Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy on Fox News on Sunday night about aid to Ukraine and the possibility he could be ousted.
There are members who want to provide aid or loan to Ukraine and others who do not. So as the Speaker of the House, how do you decide what to put on the floor, how much of the majority is enough, and when to put it on the floor?
Yeah, great question. Look, what we have to do in an era of divided government, historically as we are, is you got to build consensus. If we want to move a partisan measure, I've got to have every single member, literally. And some things need to be bipartisan. Now, we're talking about the supplemental that everybody's heard so much about, which is the thing that the president presented several months ago. He called it the National Security Supplemental, and he included Ukraine, Israel, the Taiwan Indo-Pacific region, and also the border. And we said, thank you, Mr. President, because we've all said, if we're going to talk about national security, it begins at our own border. And so we've been trying to use that as the only leverage we have to force change on the border. We're still trying to force the president to use his executive authority. And most of the American people know that he has that authority, but he's not using it because they opened the border intentionally. But when it comes to the supplemental, we've been working to build that consensus. We've been talking to all the members, especially now over the district work period. When we return after this work period, we'll be moving a product, but it's going to, I think, have some important innovations. The Repo Act, you know, if we could use the seized assets of Russian oligarchs to allow the Ukrainians to fight them, that's just pure poetry. Even President Trump has talked about the loan concept, where we set up, we're not just giving foreign aid, we're setting it up in a relationship where they can provide it back to us when the time is right. And then, you know, we want to unleash American energy. We want to have natural gas exports that will help unfund Vladimir Putin's war effort there. You know, there's a lot of things that we should do that make more sense and that I think we'll have consensus around. We're putting that product together and we'll be moving it right after the district work period.
Speaker, there is a pending motion to vacate from a member from Georgia, which sort of illustrates where we are politically. We lost two Senate seats in Georgia. Republicans did, two eminently winnable Senate seats. I would think members' time would be better spent looking to reclaim those two Senate seats in Georgia, as opposed to hanging the sword of Damocles over your head. But you're on Easter recess right now. How does it help the GOP grow the majority to be talking about a motion to vacate instead of talking about the border or inflation or other issues that are better for the GOP? How does this motion to vacate help win back the majority or win a bigger majority?
I don't think it does. And I think all of my other Republican colleagues recognize this is a distraction from our mission. Again, the mission is to save the republic. And the only way we can do that is if we grow the House majority, win the Senate, and win the White House. So we don't need any dissension right now. Look, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed the motion. It's not a privileged motion, so it doesn't move automatically. It's just hanging there. And she's frustrated. She and I exchanged text messages even today. We're going to talk early next week. Marjorie's a friend. She's very frustrated about, for example, the last appropriations bills. Guess what? So am I. As we discussed, Trey, these are not the perfect pieces of legislation that you and I and Marjorie would draft if we had the ability to do it differently. But with the smallest margin in U.S. history, we're sometimes going to get legislation that we don't like. And the Democrats know that when we don't all stand together with our razor-thin majority, then they have a better negotiation position. And that's why we got some of the things we didn't like. Now, we fought like warrior poets to keep some of those Senate appropriations or some of those Senate earmarks out of the bill. And we were successful in getting a lot of the terrible stuff out. But a few of them made it through, and that's what Marjorie's upset about, and I am too. But I want to talk with her about reforming the budgeting and spending process going forward. That's what Republicans are for. That's the transformational kind of changes that we can forge if we all stand together.
House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, on Fox News Sunday night, interviewed by former Republican Congressman Trey Gowdy. The House is back in session from recess next week. From the website of CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, over the past several years, the U.S. has stepped up its engagement with the Pacific Islands region, a strategically important area with deep historical ties to the U.S. In an effort to more effectively address the needs of the Pacific, the Biden administration released its first ever Pacific Partnership Strategy in 2022 and hosted two U.S. Pacific Island Country Summits in Washington in 2022 and 2023. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, representative of the U.S. to the United Nations, recently led the U.S. delegation to the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting in the Cook Islands. That was from CSIS. Ambassador Greenfield was at the CSIS event today talking about U.S. relations with the Pacific. Here was the first question.
There's been a really significant ramp up in U.S. engagement in the Pacific. Part of this ramp up has been a plethora of promises from this administration, new embassies, as you said, banking, investment, climate change. Having been out to the Pacific and heard from the Pacific leaders and talked to them, where do you think the U.S. should really be prioritizing as we look ahead?
That's an excellent question, and it's a question that I was asked by the Pacific Islanders when I was there. Because what they said to me is, we're used to you guys showing up once. We're used to you paying a moment of attention to us. But what we need to know is this a commitment? Are we going to see you again? Is it more than just showing up? Are you going to honor all of the commitments that you've made? And I was able to assure them that we were, that our intention was for a long-term relationship. The COFA funding, I think, is the first indication of that because it's funding for 2 decades. Mm. And that was just passed through Congress. And for our members of Congress and staff who are in the audience, I want to thank you for that because that was an extraordinary commitment that actually showed the Pacific Island nations that we're in it for the long term.
U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Linda Thomas-Greenfield, at a CSIS discussion in Washington today. COFA is the Compact of Free Association, international agreements between the U.S. and 3 Pacific Island sovereign states, Federated States of Micronesia, Republic of the Marshall Islands, and the Republic of Palau. WBZ-TV in Boston reports that former Massachusetts Congressman William Delahunt died at the age of 82 on Saturday. His family said he died peacefully after battling a long-term illness. He was a member of the Democratic Party, served in the 10th Congressional District from 1997 to 2011. Senator Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, putting out a statement, "I met with Bill in Quincy in February, and he was clear and as committed as ever to working on behalf of the South Shore and the people of Massachusetts. It's a fitting honor that the door of the William D. Delahunt Norfolk County Courthouse opens every day so that the people inside can do the hard work of making lives better, as Bill Delahunt did. The Commonwealth and the country are better for Bill Delahunt's vision and service." That statement from Senator Ed Markey. And from C-SPAN's video library, here's a portion of Congressman Delahunt's final House floor speech in 2010.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And before I begin, let me extend a note of gratitude to the ranking member from Texas for his kind and generous words. I also want to indicate that I'm wearing a tie that has Cape Cod emblazoned on this tie that was given to me by Mr. Smith in behalf of the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee. At the time, I didn't know whether it was a sign of respect or affection. Later, I learned it was because I continually wear Cape Cod ties that they were concerned that I had no tie without a stain on it. So, Lamar, thank you. Thank you for those kind words. It's been truly an honor to serve with you and the Republicans on the Judiciary Committee these past 14 years. We've done, I think, extraordinary work. We've done it together. We've had our disagreements, but those disagreements oftentimes yielded a consensus that worked for the benefit of the American people.
Congressman William Delahunt, Democrat from Massachusetts, on the House floor in 2010, the year that he stopped serving in Congress. He passed away this past weekend at the age of 82. NBC News has an article about the death that has this paragraph. President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela posted a statement on X mourning Delahunt's passing. As a member of Congress, Della Hunt brokered a 2005 deal with then-Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to obtain heating oil for low-income Massachusetts residents. According to news reports, Della Hunt also attended Chavez's state funeral in Caracas in 2013. And finally, on C-SPAN Radio's Washington Today, on this April Fool's Day, this from the White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre.
So I have something at the top for all of you. I think you'll be really interested in this. So President Biden is scheduled to announce he is revoking the Hatch Act. So as a gift to all of you, so now I can actually take all your questions about 2024. No? I thought you would love that. All right, okay. April Fools. It is April 1st. Thank you. I thought that was pretty slick of me. Thank you very much. Thank you.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, the Hatch Act of 1939 prohibits civil service employees in the executive branch from engaging in some forms of political activities. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.